And your new all-time NCAA leading scorer, Caitlin.
Get ready to see more ads like that one. It's a Nike ad celebrating Caitlin Clark.
Caitlin Clark about to take it to the bank. The Wall Street Journal reports the basketball superstar is about to sign a Nike endorsement deal worth $28 million. Oof. Yeah, she already has deals with State Farm, Gatorade, and other brands valued at more than $3 million. Clark's deal with Nike includes a signature shoe.
Well, make room in your closets because you'll soon get a chance to buy Caitlin Clark shoes.
Last month, news broke about Caitlin Clark's Nike shoe deal. It's undoubtedly a great business decision for Nike and Caitlin as she transitions into becoming the most hyped WNBA rookie of all time. But the announcement also begets a conversation about equity in the WNBA. In a league that is nearly 64% black, the most marketed, endorsed, featured players are mostly white. ESPN's Sean Hurd wrote about this for Anscape. And ESPN's Katie Barnes has extensively covered women's basketball and its intersection with issues of race and gender. They're both here today to discuss the implications of Caitlin's Nike deal on the rest of the league. I'm David Dennis Jr. It's Friday, May 10th. This is ESPN Daily. All right, Katie, Sean, we're going to be talking a lot about sneakers for the next few minutes. Before we do that, I have a very, very important question. It's time for a sneaker check. What are we wearing? We can't show people. It's a podcast, but tell us what you got on your feet at this very moment of putting you guys on the spot.
I can go first. I'm wearing a overworn pair of Puma Pacer Futures.
Sean, Pumas, man. We're wearing Pumas right now. What are those? Come on, man.
Hey, don't kill me, man. Don't kill me. They're just a walking shoe.
Cool. Katie, what about you?
I am wearing a pair of Nike Air Force Ones from a few years ago from their Be True collection that I affectionately refer to as my Gay Force Ones.
Oh, nice. Okay. Classics. Okay. That's nice. I am actually wearing socks at the moment, so I lose. Okay, guys. I feel like I think we're all on the same accord and the same page here. When I say this, I'm going to speak for us a little bit here, is that this whole conversation is not really about Caitlin Clark. It's not really about what Caitlin Clark not deserving a shoe deal. I would think that we could all agree that she absolutely deserves this thing, right?
Yeah, I think we can definitely agree. I think most people objectively completely understand the decision that Nike has made here and largely from a business perspective think it's a good one. Certainly I do.
Yep, totally on board. You know, I think this is just a smart business move by Nike, and it kind of the conversation that we're having is not at all meant to kind of diminish the accomplishment of Clark or minimize kind of her star power. And so, you know, everything that she's gotten to this point, you know, has been earned by what she's produced on the floor. I think this is just a larger conversation now about kind of everyone else and kind of everyone else receiving their due as well.
So let's get to it. Caitlin Clark obviously has been the big name coming out of everyone's mouth this year, and that's not stopping anytime soon, of course. The newly drafted Indiana Fever guard, she just signed a $28 million deal with Nike that includes getting a signature shoe. Katie Barnes, how big is this, and what does it say about her star power?
Yeah, the reported shoe deal is a very big deal. I don't think there is really any way to overstate the magnitude of what this means for women's basketball generally, in that it wasn't that long ago that many women's basketball shoe deals were product only. And here you have a player not just getting paid, but getting paid real money. And I think the biggest question moving forward is what does that actually mean for the future? Is this a one-off for Caitlin Clark and her phenomenal star power, or is this going to lift the entire market and open the door for other players to, one, get paid, and two, have their own shoes?
Oh, when you say product only, what do you mean by that as opposed to like a signature shoe?
Meaning that instead of getting paid to wear Nike shoes, they just got Nike product. Or they got Adidas product or whatever product was there that, you know, a lot of the deals you know, not that long ago, were product focused rather than we're cutting you a check to wear our product.
Sean Hurd, can you take us through sort of this history in the WNBA and who's had signature shoes in the past?
Yeah, so, you know, for the WNBA, it starts with Cheryl Swoopes. She had the first signature shoe for a WNBA player that originally released in 1995.
I just love basketball. This girl can play. I want to play one-on-one against myself. I want to teach my son that you can achieve anything you want, and I will always play this game I love. This is who I am. I am Cheryl Swoopes.
Since then, it's a rather short list, so I feel like I can name them all. But Rebecca Lobo was next, and then Lisa Leslie, Dawn Staley, Cynthia Cooper, Nikki McCray-Penson, Shamika Holtzclaw, Diana Taurasi, Candace Parker, and then when you now look at active players, you have Sabrina Ionescu, Brianna Stewart, and Elena Deladon, who isn't going to play in 2024. But that's the list, 12 total. So Caitlin Clark will become number 13.
Okay, so I'm going through this list. You're naming these names. Obviously, this is a who's who of WNBA superstars, a lot of MVPs, Hall of Famers in there. And it's obviously a lofty bar to join that list, but I cannot go further without pointing out the fact that that list is very, very white, especially when we talk about the current players who have shoe deals. Katie, can you speak a little bit to why that is?
It's a really hard question to answer, to be candid. You know, there have been ongoing discussions in recent years about who gets to be a WNBA superstar, who is going to be promoted at that level, who has access to the kind of promotion and endorsements that would allow an athlete to stay home instead of go play overseas, as has historically been the custom in WNBA. And with that, you know, as the WNBA has started to gain traction, it has done so at a time when major Black superstars are retiring. So thinking about Tamika Catchings retiring, Maya Moore retiring, Candace Parker now retiring, and also the emergence of a number of talents who are very good at basketball and who are white. And so looking at Sabrina Ionescu, Brianna Stewart, Elena Deladon, and now Caitlin Clark. And it's created this dynamic where it becomes very jarring to look at a league that is predominantly Black and see the representation of who is getting major promotional deals not reflect that reality. And then also when it leaves out one of the biggest superstars in the league, who is Asia Wilson, it becomes very hard to ignore the racial dynamics at play.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, the emergence of the players and their prominence in terms of like who's the best players, things like that. But when you look at the WNBA postseason awards, 80% of the winners are Black. And obviously we talk about a league that's mostly Black. And there was also a shift here, right? That Sean, you mentioned the names earlier. There were a lot of Black women in this list, and it seems to have changed. So, you know, can you speak to some of the shift and what, in your opinion, where that came from?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can start with kind of, you know, pointing out that shift, like you mentioned. You know, Candace Parker is the last Black woman to have a signature shoe. She had a signature shoe with Adidas in 2010 and 2011.
Your shoes, Exhibit Select, have been designed specifically with female athletes in mind. Normally, it's not been like that.
I think it makes a huge difference being able to have something that's for you and represents you. I think now we're going to positionless basketball. And I think just as women, we come in all shapes and sizes. And sometimes those sizes that are big don't necessarily stand by the basket. Maybe they shoot threes, and sometimes those guards post up. And so you got to have a shoe that can do both.
Absolutely.
But also, women having a shoe, that's pretty dope. So 100%. we'll drink some champagne to that.
And then, you know, if you want to look at, you know, Nike, which Caitlin Clark signed with, the last time a Black woman had a Nike signature shoe was more than two decades ago. With Cheryl Swoopes and the Nike Air Swoopes premiere, which was in 2002. you know, it's a really interesting question that I'm not sure anyone really has the answer to, except for the decision makers who decide who gets the signature shoe. I think when I was writing the piece talking about Asia Wilson and kind of where her shoe deal is, you kind of question, you know, what are the factors that are limiting her from getting that green light? You know, is it a question of maybe folks don't think that she can connect with a broader demographic? Isn't an assumption of, you know, potential Black spending power that is in doubt? All these questions are kind of coming to the surface when we don't really have that answer as to why the shift has occurred, when there hasn't really been a lack of Black superstars within the league.
Yeah, we're definitely going to get to Asia Wilson. This is an important cog in this story. But Katie, first, I want to talk about, did you wrote an ESPN cover story posing a very important question. Who gets to be a WNBA superstar? Tell us what you found out in your reporting.
Yeah, you know, that piece spent a lot of time looking at Jonquel Jones. This piece published in 2022, I believe. And in that, you know, at the time she was the reigning MVP. It was, you know, her last season with the Connecticut Sun. She did have a State Farm commercial.
A lot of people assume NBA players can reach anything. Just like they assume they can't afford great insurance. But State Farm has rates that fit any budget.
Here you go.
Thanks, Jonquel.
But, you know, there were a lot of questions around why wasn't she getting more? And those are questions that she was raising publicly. And so in the course of that story, you know, I explored that question from a variety of angles, including delving into some of those numbers, David, that you alluded to earlier, which, you know, points to a study that was done by Dr. Risa Isard, who at the time was at the University of Massachusetts and now is at UConn, that looked at the number of media mentions that Black players were getting in comparison to white players. And in that study, she found that, you know, while 80% of the postseason award winners in the 2020 season were Black, they received half as many mentions in the media as their white counterparts. Even when you were looking at a player specifically in Asia Wilson, who was the MVP that year, who received half as many mentions as, you know, Sabrina Ionescu, who only played 3 games that season before being injured. So there's this real disparity that was highlighted in that particular academic study between how media members were treating Black and white players and who was getting coverage and who was being explored as, you know, the face of the league. And now, you know, there's these questions around endorsements. You know, the reason why there's such a discussion around endorsements in particular in women's basketball is that is an essential supplemental income for these athletes who traditionally have gone overseas to make additional money. That income is seen as essential in a way that is simply not the case for their male counterparts. And that was something one of the agents said to me, was that, you know, there are players in the NBA who can just not have social media. You just don't have to do interviews. You don't have to have endorsements. That's all extra because they're paid so much money. In the women's game, that's not the case. If you don't want to go overseas and you want to have enough to retire on when your body is done, the endorsements, the secondary opportunities have an outsized influence. And so then the question becomes who gets to access those? And what we're seeing is that largely a lot of that discussion is being centered around white players.
You know, you mentioned Isard in the studies in this piece. One of the things that really stuck out to me is the quote here that they found that Black players of more masculine gender expression received the least amount of coverage. And that brings us back to Jonquel Jones. When you think about the 2021 season, WNBA had announced their top jersey sales in a league, you know, again, that was majority Black. 50% of the top 10 jersey sales were belonging to white players. But none of them sort of were at this intersection that Jones had, which was Black, gay, and sort of masculine presenting. Can you talk about Jones and that intersection, how that has played a part in the way that she is presented as a superstar in the WNBA?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a really important call out in that this conversation is very layered and it is very intersectional. You know, we could have this discussion about racial identity, but we know it's not just racial identity. And we also know it's not just about queerness and queer identity, right? Breanna Stewart, who is white and openly gay, she still has the means to access certain benefits in terms of her endorsement deals and, of course, her signature shoe, et cetera, et cetera. But so when you're overlaying these identities, that disadvantage compounds itself. That is especially true when we're looking at race and then sexual orientation and then gender expression. That's where we get like that masculine of center presenting. And so there are a number of players who sit at that intersection. And it was something that Jonquil talked about a lot as somebody who was questioning what makes her different. She was looking around and seeing, well, she sits at that intersection. And that is challenging for her. And then that's further compounded by, you know, going to play at the New York Liberty, right, where she is one of many options on that team. However, you look at Breanna Stewart, who's a superstar, and you look at Sabrina Ionescu, who's considered a superstar. They have not necessarily seen their opportunities recede. Whereas with Jones, I think it's fair to say that her opportunities have receded in a certain sense. And some of that has to do with play, of course, and some of that has to do with all of these other factors as well.
Coming up, we turn to superstars Asia Wilson and Angel Reese.
Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore a seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
So both of y'all have mentioned Asia Wilson, who is an absolutely fascinating piece in all of this. Because to me, Asia Wilson is one of the most marketable, charismatic athletes in all the sports. And there's like tons of marketing people who feel like they've dropped the ball by not building brands around her and the way that she does interviews and just her charisma. She has the silver hair now that she does. And it's an incredible, preseason photo. Sean, I wanted to hone in on this and talk about why Asia Wilson does not have a signature shoe of her own. She's had either the same amount of success as the names mentioned earlier. Why doesn't she make the cut? As I mentioned, she is as marketable, I think, as anybody in sports right now.
Yeah, I think if we're just looking at accolades, right? We're looking at a back-to-back champion, finals MVP. She's a former MVP, defensive player of the year. She's won Olympic gold medal. So it's the accolades are aplenty, right? And that's always, or as most would think, would be part of the equation. You mentioned kind of the personality, and if you just watch any Asia Wilson clip, she has one of the most infectious personalities and likable personalities in the league. She has cultural relevancy as well. We've seen her in music videos and in other spaces. She was just announced as a member of Time's most influential people. Her leg sleeve innovation that we see her rock on the court game in and game out, that has kind of permeated bigs in the league and then also bigs at the NCAA level. And so her influence has been proven. It's just a matter of acknowledging it at this point.
I just want to underscore that the single leg sleeve has become such a phenomenon. It's gone even beyond bigs. It also includes guards. Also, you can see some players in the men's college game who rock a single leg sleeve. And my personal favorite was LeBron shooting threes with his single leg sleeve and his short shorts rolled up in the front, just like Asia does, just absolutely killing it. So all I'm saying is, yes, Sean, the single leg sleeve is maybe the single most revolutionary piece of on-court fashion we've seen in the last half decade. No question. She's an incredible talent, and she's also an incredible talent off the court. And she moves merchandise. She's a New York Times bestselling author. And I don't have to tell you, David, as somebody, we've both written books, that is a hard thing to accomplish.
Yeah.
The issue moving forward It's something that's going to be further compounded as, you know, we have a superstar like Angel Reese who's entering into the league. And what she will do on the court remains to be an open question, but certainly her cultural resonance off the court, is going to demand attention and is going to move merchandise and is going to put butts in seats. And so will the shoe market respond to that in a meaningful way? I think Asia, in many respects, encapsulates the frustration because, as Sean pointed out, she has exceeded expectations. Her resume is longer in some ways, and yet she still has not received her due in the ways that many of her fans would like her to. And what will that mean for new Black superstars as well?
You know, if I could just add off of that as well, I think there is an expectation that an announcement for a shoe for Asia is coming. But I think the issue that you run into is when it does come out, it's going to feel like it's overdue instead of on time. And I think that is the difference when you look at a player like Caitlin Clark, where Nike met the timing, right? Katie mentioned Angel Reese. Perhaps the timing could have been right for Angel in just the way that we've seen her popularity. But then you look also at kind of history. And you know, I think Diana Taurasi got her shoe pretty early. Sabrina got her shoe pretty early. But it seems like when it comes to other players, they have to kind of prove themselves in a way that maybe others haven't in the past before getting a shoe. And sometimes you don't get a shoe altogether. I think something that's so interesting is Caitlin Clark's, you know, hero in hoops was Maya Moore, and Maya Moore never got a shoe.
Yeah, I mean, let's continue on with Angel Reese, who's sort of a fascinating wrinkle in this. Is that she comes into the league with the shoe deal that she signed with Reebok in October of last year. And, you know, what do you expect from this shoe deal? Sean, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, hitting her at the right spot, but what do you expect from the actual shoe deal and Angel Reese coming to the league?
I think Angel mentioned recently that she, you know, if she's able to kind of perform on the court, that she would expect a signature shoe with Reebok. So, I mean, that'll be something to definitely keep an eye on and see if that materializes. But again, as we've mentioned, there's no shortage of kind of cultural relevancy and hype around Angel and, you know, her presence right now. I think you can turn to that preseason game, you know, recently where, you know, over 100,000 people were watching on a live stream of Chicago's preseason game versus Minnesota.
I just wanted to add on to that. Like, when we talk about the cultural relevancy of Angel Reese, I don't know that people fully appreciate the level of her celebrity because, you know, for us as ESPN folks, we're so focused on the sports of it all. And Caitlin Clark commands a lot of that attention. But when you look at the social media numbers around Angel, it is staggering. She has well over 6 million followers between Instagram and TikTok. Her Instagram following is significantly larger than Caitlin Clark's. I think it's at almost 1 million larger at this point. At one point, before the postseason blow up for both Clark as well as Paige Beckers from UConn, Angel had more Instagram followers than Cameron Brink, Paige Beckers, and Caitlin Clark combined.
She has more followers than the WNBA total.
Absolutely. Sorry, just... I mean, the attention that she commands is considerable, and it is across platforms, whether you're looking at Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. She is a force in that way.
Yeah, and despite that force that she is, Katie, I want to talk about what happened this weekend with the WNBA. The League Pass only aired the Indiana Fever's preseason game against the Dallas Wings, of course, to highlight Caitlin Clark. They didn't show the Chicago Sky Minnesota Lynx game. And as Sean mentioned, hundreds of thousands of people were turned into a grainy iPhone video of somebody in the stands watching this game because that's how much they wanted to see Angel Reese. And of course, Cardozo was also a rookie coming into that team. Talk to me about that moment, Katie, and what that represents for the WNBA.
Well, I actually think that that particular moment is one of reckoning for lots of stakeholders, including media, in that when you look at, you know, how games end up on League Pass, how games end up on television, it's not always as simple as, you know, the WNBA decides this game is on League Pass versus this game. somebody has to produce the games. And that means somebody has to pay for those games and negotiate those rights and put them on the air. And so if a national media partner wanted to air that game, they probably could have. And also, if a local media partner wanted to air that game, they probably could have. And so that, to me, is something that is worth asking. Well, how is it decided what games go where? Who is responsible for producing those games? Who is responsible for assigning value in terms of what games like that are worth? And then also recognizing the tremendous area of growth that we're seeing for the W, which is that a couple years ago, preseason games on League Pass wasn't even a discussion people were having. And now, because there is such a fervor around the incoming rookies across teams and desire to see those teams play, and it doesn't matter if it's preseason, there's a question about how can I access those games? And you know, I think that is the ongoing question for the W, for individual franchises and for media members, which is that this is very clearly a moment in the WNBA's history that could be seen as an inflection point in terms of trajectory. And so is everyone who has a stake in this league prepared to meet that moment and is prepared with the infrastructure to make sure that these games are seen and are covered? And that, I think, is something that we're going to really find out over the course of this season. I think we'll probably be having a conversation similar to this one in terms of the accessibility of games more than once.
I just want to circle back to one thing about Angel. I think we could all agree that there has been some irresponsible portrayals of Reese as some sort of villain during the tournament, especially these last couple of years. Katie, how do you think something like that impacts her marketability?
Well, I think that ties into the conversation around where we started, which was talking about the ways in which race and perceptions around race influence your marketability, right? Or could influence your marketability. And so Angel is somebody who's fiercely competitive and she talks a lot. She loves to talk. And she also is aggressive on the court. And because she is a Black woman, she's disproportionately punished for those things in terms of the perception of her as, quote, not being a role model. I think that's something that you see in the way that folks on social media talk about her. Whereas other athletes who are not Black, who are also competitive, who also have an edge, and I would put Caitlin Clark into that category, right? Like she has an edge. She isn't punished in the same way. And that does have to do with the way that race functions in our culture and in our society. And so in that sense, I think that there is a possibility that Angel is disproportionately punished by decision makers for the way that she carries herself on the court, per se. But overall, I think people love who Angel is on the court and off the court. I think they love that fire and that passion. And it can cut both ways, but that's true for every single competitive athlete, whether we're talking about Angel Reese or Kobe Bryant or Caitlin Clark or Diana Taurasi, right? They all have that edge. And that was something that, really showed itself in my reporting around her last year.
Well, yeah, speaking of, a lot of the reporting and stuff that you've done, the way in the players that you've talked to, what have you heard from players about what pressures there are to conform or to change to fit a mold that they perceive, the general public wants for them to be more marketable?
Well, I think Courtney Williams talked about that the best in the story that I did about Jonquel, where she, talked about, being masculine of center and, being queer and, just expressing herself authentically. She said that she thought that she might have lost some money, but whatever, like that was fine. She wasn't going to hide who she is. And that was 2 years ago, right? And I do think, though, as we see more and more capital come into women's basketball, I wonder what that will do in terms of the inclusive culture that has emerged in the WNBA, the changes that we've started to see on the college level. Suddenly there are higher and higher stakes around your possible NIL deals around your endorsements? And how will brands respond to athletes being authentically themselves? And athletes who have an expectation that they can be who they are and dress how they want and express themselves how they want. Will there be an increase in pressure to conform? Even more than we, you know, saw in at the time that Courtney was talking about it. You know, that is something that I am personally keeping an eye on because I wonder about it in terms of who is going to get access to this capital.
Coming up, what will it take to change who gets access to this capital?
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So this all is a topic, of course, that's generating more buzz and attention as the weeks and months go by. While it does feel that the tides are turning for the WNBA as a whole, what will it take for the marketing of WNBA's superstars to be representative of the demographics of the league, Sean?
You know, I think part of that answer could be perhaps, you know, tied to, you know, what we're seeing now with kind of, you know, the rise and spotlight on the sport and how that attention can, you know, potentially lead to some kind of tangible change. And kind of, here's why, like I say that if you followed the WNBA closely since Asia Wilson came into the league, which is in 2018, you know that the Asia Wilson shoe conversation happens almost every season. Or has happened every season since she's been in the league. But the attention on the game today, I kind of paired with the news cycle around Caitlin Clark's Nike signing, it amplified this topic and this discussion in a way that I haven't seen since Asia, you know, entered the league. It felt like real tangible attention was placed, you know, on this issue, and kind of felt loud enough that it could reach a much, you know, larger crowd than it has, again, since, you know, Asia came into the WNBA. I would also add that, you know, the league itself has begun to, you know, try and take steps. If you look at the latest cohort of their player marketing program, which is a product of the last collective bargaining agreement, it was created as a way of keeping WNBA stars stateside instead of going overseas during the offseason and having players be compensated for participating in league marketing initiatives. The last iteration of that class, you know, they're all Black players. Jewel Lloyd, Arike Ogunbowale, Aaliyah Boston, they were all a part of this class. Brian Howard. And the person who oversees this whole program is Bethany Donovan, who is the head of operations for the league. And she herself is a Black woman. So when you kind of look at least, are there steps being made, you know, towards at least in-house getting the marketing of superstars and the demographic of the league? I think there are steps there. we all kind of see how the league is kind of just a microcosm of how, you know, Black women are treated, marketed societally, and the challenges that we've already discussed. So the issue is, of course, bigger than the WNBA.
We have a similar situation brewing next year with Paige Bueckers. She'll probably get a big shoe deal. She'll probably have all the media attention coming into the league. She'll probably get tons of endorsements. What could happen to make this system more equitable for everybody so we can see different athletes from different backgrounds and different intersectionalities get these same benefits?
Yeah, one of the most impactful things that I think about that Jonquel Jones told me when we were talking for this story a couple of years ago, was she was talking about how she's not trying to, like, you know, kick people out from the table. Like, this isn't a mindset of scarcity. What she is asking for, and I think what fans of these athletes are asking for, is that access to the table be broadened, that the table be bigger, that there be more seats, not fewer. And, you know, a lot of folks are trying to have this conversation from a place of abundance. And I think that's where it should be. And so we spent a lot of time talking about Caitlin Clark's getting this, Sabrina Ionescu has this, Brianna Stewart has this. And I don't think either of us are trying to say that they shouldn't have that. It's not a either or conversation. It's a both and. And that, yes, these athletes are incredibly accomplished. They should be recognized for those accomplishments. They should leverage that to as many deals as they can possibly get. And also, all athletes, no matter their background, no matter the intersection at which they sit, should have the access and the opportunity to do the same. And that is, I think, the crux of the conversation that, you know, we've tried to have today and that we're seeing play out more culturally and more broadly.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Sean. Thank you both for your insight and for coming here on the pod.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm David Dennis Jr. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by
Bruce Baldwin,
Ashley Brown,
Bradford Craig,
Alexander Hyacin,
Ryan Nantel,
Mike Philbrick,
and Phoebe Untermann.
Special thanks to Andrew Hahn and Jackson Agello. We'll talk to you on Monday.